Inselmulkom u nilqawkom għal program bil-ħaq u sewa. Program imtella mill-laqda student tal-liġi u prezentat minni Ived Borġ u mill-kollega tiegħi Alistair Buġejja. Il-program tal-lum u għed speċjali l-ewwel nett għax se jixxandar bil-lingwa Ingliża. Għax magħna fl-istudio għandna l-Dr. Sean Donlin, studius tal-liġi u lecturer ġewwa l-Università fl-Irlanda u l-Dr. David Zammit, avukat Head of Civil Department u Lecturer fil Legal Anthropology ġewwa l-Università ta' Malta. L-lum se nitkellmu magħhom dwar l-istudju tagħhom fuq il-liġi.
Different legal systems have their particular traditions. Dr. Donlan, can you highlight for us the main legal traditions?
Well, in Europe, and generalizing considerably, they would be what I would call the continental traditions, or civil law, and Anglo-American, or common law traditions. There are many others around the world, but those are the main in Europe, and because of colonization and intellectual influence, they also influence much of the world.
Dr. Zammit, you and Dr. Donlan are collaborating on a joint academic project. Can you describe the nature of this project?
Yes, this is basically a project involving, on the one hand, joint teaching, and on the other, joint research. In terms of teaching, Dr. Donlan and I have been co-teaching a course to the third year law students on comparative legal systems and legal pluralism, where he has focused more on the comparative legal systems bit, and me, given my interest in legal anthropology, on the legal pluralism part. The other aspect of our joint project is research, and we are basically trying, from our different perspectives, to try to understand and classify the Maltese legal system in terms of other legal systems, particularly other mixed legal systems.
Dr. Donlan, can you say more about mixed legal systems?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to say that no legal system is pure, at least none that I know of. There may be a tribe somewhere that hasn't been influenced or infected by laws from outside, but every legal tradition, including Anglo-American, including the continental traditions, are in fact also the result of mixtures of laws. But generally the term is reserved for those that are mixtures of those traditions that we recognize as significant today, so the continental, common law, Islamic law, and many others. And in particular, the phrase mixed jurisdictions is often reserved to mixtures of European law, again, the continental and Anglo-American traditions.
Dr. Donlan describes Malta's legal system as a mixed legal system because it combines elements of common law and of civil law. Do you agree with this description?
Yes, substantially yes. It's undoubtedly the case that the Maltese legal system has many of the characteristics of mixed jurisdictions, and I think that this is the label which perhaps best captures our system. However, having said that, the nature of the mixity, so to speak, in the Maltese system is very complex. In other words, the tendency might be to simply think, okay, we have some laws which come from one area and some laws which come from another system, as it were. However, from another family of systems. However, what you find is that even where you are operating in an area of law, for example, which derives from the civilian tradition, from the civilian family, you might find, for instance, that judges might be reasoning in a way which is closer to common law judges. So it's not so much the case that we have a mixed system in the sense of having separate sectors coexisting side by side, which don't influence one another. When operating, for example, within the field of private law, where one would expect, particularly in, you know, traditional property cases or whatever, that those would be mainly influenced by Roman law and by the civilian family, you might find that even the way in which judges reasoning might bear many traits of the common law approach. I could give another example of this, for instance, in the area of tort law, where you find that traditionally in the English system, the focus is always on remedies, not on rights. So if you have a remedy, then you will have some form of compensation. Whereas in the civilian system, the focus is on having a right. And if you have a right, then you have a remedy. In Malta, you find that in the field of tort law, which is supposed to be mainly civilian, judges very often reason in the English way by saying, if we do not have a particular remedy, if we don't accept it, then you don't have a right to compensation.
Is this healthy for our system, though?
There is clearly a lot of debate as to whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, and the initial tendency is to say that it is not, because if one conforms completely to one particular legal family, then in a sense there is much more likely to be logical coherence in the decisions of the courts, for example, and there is more likely to be uniformity of the law and of the principles applied. However, it certainly is the case that our system is like that. It's basically an empirical fact. So it's, in a way, the question whether it's healthy or not, this is the system we have. Certainly elements to attempts, that is, to impose by law uniformity, in other words, to eliminate the mixedness by an act of the legislator, could possibly backfire. Because what can happen as a result is that one actually provokes more resistance in favor of the system. And one final thing which should be said about the Maltese legal system, which of course reflects also Maltese history and Maltese culture, is that it does generate a great deal of creativity. Because in a sense, our lawyers are just like people who are continuously translating legal concepts. And therefore, they are often more versatile and more adept at handling, at shifting from one kind of argument to another totally different one than lawyers elsewhere. So it has its advantages. It is not necessarily just a defect.
During your stay in Malta, you have delivered a number of lectures with regards to your studies of comparative law. Can you say something on your approach?
Sure. The lectures are being delivered as part of a course that I'm teaching with Dr. David Zammit at the university. The course title is Comparative Legal Systems and Legal Pluralism. And it's a combination of the techniques or the approach of a comparative lawyer, that is me, and in particular a person who adopts a legal historical perspective, with those of a social scientist, or in this case a legal anthropologist, Dr. Zammit. A combination of those two approaches, and it's consistent with other things that he and I are working on.
Dr. Zammit, does it make any difference in practice whether the Maltese system is described as mixed or not?
Well, given that I have just said that in reality, I don't think it's possible, it's not something we have all that much choice about. We can't just eliminate the mixity or mixedness overnight. This might seem to be merely a project aimed at some kind of academic classification or theoretical classification. However, I feel that actually, if we really were to internalize the fact that we have this mixed legal system and think about it and try to grapple with it, it could have radical transformative implications for both the practice of law, the teaching of law, and also the way ordinary people relate to our legal system. Let me try to elaborate on each of these points. When it comes to the practice of law, there is often a distinction made between lawyers who are pragmatists, that is, who operating within a mixed legal system would simply take elements from each system in order to suit their own purposes. Lawyers who are purists, who insist, no, we should remain within the logic of one of the systems. And lawyers who are pollutionists, who creatively take what they need as a deliberate act, so close to pragmatism, but actually going further than that. Now, I think that when it comes to the practice of law in Malta, many of these questions are not even being raised, or at least they are not being raised in a reflective manner. So what happens is people are not even making the choice to be pragmatic or to be pollutionist or to be purist. They are simply reasoning from these standpoints without even thinking about that. So I think it could have profound implications if these choices were to be made clear and if they were to be discussed on the way in which courts reach judgments. It could influence very much the evolution of our law. When it comes to the teaching of law, again, you find a kind of a battle going on. I had the civil law department at university, traditionally a bastion of the civilian tradition, whereas you find other departments which are more influenced by common law and where there's hardly any reference made to the civilian tradition. Now, the tendency, even when drafting course curricula or thinking about what the law course should be like, is very often for everyone to try to insist on his definition of what the Maltese legal system is. Whereas I think that if we were to actually internalize the fact that it's a mixed system and that this, whether it has its advantages or not, is the system we have, so let's start to begin by understanding it and promoting research which actually tackles the mixedness, it would create much more scope for, how shall I put it, collaboration between different departments and for a curriculum which is much more adventurous. In other words, which doesn't treat our students as being half-baked common law lawyers or half-baked civilian lawyers, but which treats them as fully versed lawyers from a mixed legal system who have the advantages of that and who can refer to textbooks, particularly, for example, from other mixed legal systems. So that's from the teaching point of view. Did I leave something out here? No. Okay, good.
In his research, Professor Palmer focused on his studies on the so-called literal legal family. Can you highlight its development?
Well, the third legal family is, as I see it, a subset of mixed jurisdictions. That is, mixed jurisdictions are a mixture of the two European traditions. The third legal family, as he articulates the argument, are those traditions that are so close, though they're mixed, are so close to one another that they can gain quite a lot from talking to one another. And these include, if I can remember them all correctly, Israel, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, South Africa, and Scotland. Now, there are others that he doesn't focus on, and to be honest, one that he doesn't get to is Malta. And so the question, or an important question that I'm trying to answer, is whether or not Malta is part of this third legal family. Malta clearly is a mixed jurisdiction of the different European traditions, but is it in fact a member of the third legal family? Is it, as I put it earlier to someone, is it a brother or a cousin? How far or how close is Malta to these others designated as third legal families?
Dr. Zamit, do you think it is possible to say that one of the traditions, the civilian or the common law, has had more influence in Malta? If so, which and why?
I don't actually think it's possible to answer that question in an affirmative way. Precisely because the kind of mixing which one finds very often occurs in places where one would not expect to find it. And this is perhaps where I would like also to refer to the benefits of an anthropological approach to the issue. That is, if one thinks about the civilian family of legal systems or the common law family of legal systems, not simply as an assembly of legal rules or institutions or procedures, but also as a matter of culture, of mentality. And if one were to try to compare the legal culture, for instance, of a civilian judge with that of a common law judge, or the legal culture of a civilian trial with that of a common law trial, what one finds is that there are major differences. For example, most law students are aware of the difference between the American discovery procedure and the emphasis that they make on pretrial hearings and so on in the course of an ordinary court case, and the traditional civilian focus on a kind of inquisitorial process where much more control is vested in the judge when asking questions to witnesses, when, for example, deciding what is what the case is all about, in a sense. And the contrast generally is made between the common law judge, who is considered to be basically a kind of a referee, and the civil law judge, who is considered to be a kind of a glorified inquisitor. Now, what you find in Malta is that when it comes to court proceedings, civil trials. The procedure in law is normally said to be adversarial. But then when you look at the culture of the trial, as it were, the way in which the judges and the lawyers interact with one another, you find very strong traces of the civilian approach. And, for example, pre-trial proceedings in Malta have so far not been very widely employed, at least not in the American form. There tends to be a situation, for example, where judges will take over and question the witnesses themselves instead of leaving the question. I'm not saying this is a good or bad thing. I'm just saying we have a particular tradition, a particular culture. And this culture, when one looks at it from the point of view of an anthropologist, becomes very clear, even though if one were to look at it from the standpoint of the legal rules, you would say, well, no, the legal rules make clear that this is the kind of process we have, which is primarily adversarial. But then the inquisitorial elements come out when you look at it from this anthropological point of view. So my own stance on this is that it's actually not possible to really answer this question. And I doubt whether even a very sophisticated analysis could, because of the interweaving. Because in a sense, our system is constituted by the interweaving of these traditions and by the process of linking them together. So one tends to find that in the areas where one system is emphasized most strongly, just at that point, you find elements of the other. So we always say, well, civil law is the stronghold of the civilian tradition in Malta. But then you find that when the civil trial occurs, that it is, at least formally, based on common law rules, on adversarial. But then you find the mentality of the culture of the trial is civilian. However, then you find that the judicial reasoning might have common law features. So the interweaving of the two traditions is so close that I think this question cannot be answered in Malta.
The way the role of the judge is understood in different legal systems is that of interpreting and applying the law. Do you think that these differences in legal systems affect this role?
It does. I mean, certainly between continental traditions generally and Anglo-American traditions generally, it is fundamental. It may even be, in terms of the discussion of mixed systems, Palmer says it really is where the soul of the system resides, what the judge does and what sources of law they draw on, and in particular, jurisprudence or case law. Is it binding along the lines of stare decisis? That is one previous decision binding on a court, you know, if it's lower or at the same level in a judicial hierarchy, or is there precedent not recognized in that way? That is, I would argue, and many comparativists would argue, that there is a system of precedent in continental traditions. There isn't stare decisis, so one decision isn't binding. But previous decisions are evidence of the law, and if they seem to be accurate, if there seems to be a common opinion developing among earlier judges, then those decisions are followed, not because they have to be, but because they seem to be the best evidence of the law. That system we refer to in Louisiana, and I think you use the terminology here as well, is the French terminology, jurisprudence constante, a constant stream of jurisprudence. But it's fundamentally different, at least in theory, fundamentally different from stare decisis.
Dr. Zamit, although we do not follow the doctrine of judicial precedent, one could easily argue that in certain fields of law, the judgments of our courts are so consistent and tend to echo each other's reasoning so closely that in practice they create binding precedents. Would you accept this argument? And if so, which fields would you consider as example of this?
I think that this is quite a legitimate claim. And the field of law which I tend to focus on in my own teaching here at university, which is tort law, is a very good example of this, because again, our provisions on tort are found in the civil code, which is, you know, a good example of a civilian, I mean, it is the main example of a civilian-inspired law in Malta. At the same time, however, judgments on the matter, and, you know, for the layman, when we're talking about torts, we're talking about cases where there is a traffic accident, for example, and the judges have to quantify the amount of compensation that the person who caused the accident must give to the victim who has been unjustly harmed as a result. If one looks at that field, you find that the main principles found in the civil code are all derived, of course, from the Code Napoleon, actually the Austrian civil code, and other codes which existed at the time when our civil code was drafted. But then when you look at the principles which our courts refer to when deciding what kind of compensation to give, one finds there quite a strong influence of the common law approach. And this influence of the common law approach generally takes the form of referring to a formula for compensating the amount of monetary compensation which must be paid to the victim, what in law we call the damages. This formula was developed by a Maltese court in 1967 in the famous case of Butler versus Heard, drawing very much on English law. This formula has tended to be repeated almost literally by practically all subsequent judgments in this area. Now, that doesn't mean that particular areas of the formula have not been changed or questioned, but the overall integrity of the formula has not been substantially modified since 1967 till the present. Now, when you consider how many judgments are delivered by our courts in this area, you realize that once that this is a good example of a huge mass of judgments which tend to follow one another and echo one another's reasoning quite closely. Of course, there are important reasons, commercial reasons, why this should be so, because insurance companies need to have a stable understanding of the kind of damages that would be awarded by the court in such cases. However, it's certainly the case that in this area, the number of judgments are something like one-fifth or one-sixth, at least, of all court judgments would focus on tort law. And most of these would echo once again this formula. So here we have a good example of something very close to a doctrine of precedent.
It is customary law for Maltese lawyers and judges to compare Maltese law with English, Italian, and French law. Would it be more sensible if this comparative exercise is carried out with Scots law, for example, or the law of Quebec, being also mixed jurisdictions like us?
Well, that's part of what I'm trying to sort out by determining whether or not Malta is at the heart of this third legal family. We can decide whether or not it's fruitful for Maltese lawyers to talk to these other members of that family. I don't know quite yet, again, where I would place Malta, whether or not it's at the heart of that family or not. But in any event, the conversation is an ongoing one. Scots lawyers and South African lawyers, for example, Scots lawyers and Louisiana lawyers are in conversation. There are joint publications coming out. And I think for many different reasons, I think Malta should be at that table. I think you have a lot to offer to jurists from outside, and I think they have a lot to offer for you as well.
Is it just but an academic exercise, or there is more to it?
I think certainly there is an academic benefit to be gained from the study, but I think it is more than that. I think in terms of the reform of law, in terms simply being aware of what's going on here, or on the other hand, what's going on outside, it can certainly impact the way you view the legal system, what you see as possible, what you see as wise. Much of the mixed jurisdiction literature also has been used to try to better understand the European Union and its ongoing mixture of those two European traditions. There's been a great deal of debate about whether or not there is a new jus commune, that is a new common law of Europe that includes those two traditions. And it seems to me as one of the few places in Europe where those, the continental and the Anglo-American traditions, are explicitly combined, that you have a lot to offer the European Union.
Dr. Johnlin, what about the source of law and mixed jurisdiction?
Well, again, in terms of jurisprudence, as I mentioned, Palmer says this is really important in determining where a legal system's soul is. And so if, for example, you view jurisprudence or case law as a binding source, then you're more likely to incline towards the Anglo-American tradition, depending on the situation. Perhaps a civilian background has been, a continental background has been left to the past. On the other hand, if you deny that cases are binding in the straightforward sense that are meant to be in Anglo-American traditions, then maybe you still are connected to that earlier tradition. But it's a complex subject, because even in mixed jurisdictions that claim to be continental or civilian, ironically, adopting a strict view of precedent can mean protecting that tradition against Anglo-American law. So it's all very, very complicated, but precedent is at the center of the question of whether or not a tradition is maintaining links to the continental past or not. And there are other questions as well in terms of sources of law. Legislation, different approaches to legislation exist in the continental traditions and in Anglo-American traditions. And mixed jurisdictions very often will adopt one approach in interpreting codes and one approach when they're interpreting ordinary statutes. And with a code, clearly it'll be a more continental approach. We do the same in Louisiana. With statutes or special statutes outside of the code, it may be that it looks more like Anglo-American interpretation.
Some have claimed that doctrine, the opinions of legal scholars and text writers, has less authority in the Maltese legal system than court judgments. Dr. Zamit, would you argue that this is the case?
I think that asking these kind of questions, or rather the fact that this approach generates these kinds of questions, demonstrates how productive and useful it can be for our understanding of Maltese law, because this is something which can easily slip under the radar. One would not realize that such a shift would be occurring. But it seems to me, and here I must say that, you know, this is still early days in this research, but it seems to me that there has been a gradual development in Maltese jurisprudence. By jurisprudence, we mean the judgments of the courts, particularly, again, in the civil law field, where one finds that over time, quoting other court judgments has acquired more and more importance, whereas the references to doctrine, and by doctrine I mean the opinions of text writers, has become almost of secondary importance in some cases. This is the kind of statement, however, that can only be said, can only be really said on the basis of comprehensive research, and I have not carried out such comprehensive research, so I must make clear that at this stage I'm talking mainly of an impression. But what would be the significance of this is that in reality you would have the influence of common law, that is the idea that you should quote other judgments, other judgments are more persuasive almost than the opinions of text writers, precisely in the domain where you might think that the courts are basically asserting tradition, asserting the traditional principles of civil law. So you would have in a sense a kind of a mutation of the system. Because one must remember, civil law traditionally was actually called professor's law. In other words, it was the law which the professors of the University of Bologna originally had, in a sense, reconstructed the Roman law, which they had managed to reconstruct on the basis of research undertaken. We are talking basically on the medieval period. So, in a sense, the fact that the opinions of text writers, that is of basically of legal scholars, would be taking second place would mean that the system is actually becoming closer to the common law system. This has all sorts of implications, of course, even for the way in which law is thought of and perceived, because at the end of the day, a law which emerges from the opinions of text writers might be conceived in more flexible ways and is more subject to controversy and contestation, whereas a law which emerges from the decisions of courts might be seen in more rigid ways and might be seen as more fixed and less subject to questioning or contestation. So this has also implications for the mentality, for how we think about law. And at this point, in fact, with your permission, I'd like to go back to the earlier point I was making, which is about the influence or the impact that acknowledging that we operate in a mixed legal system might have on the way, in a sense, the Maltese legal system is advertised. By advertised, I simply mean the way in which people become aware or are made aware of the fact that, you know, in Malta we have a system of laws and of courts. I feel that one aspect of this which has to be taken into account is the attitude of the layperson to the law. Very often the law is encountered, for example, when somebody goes to court for the first time for a court case. And I think that immediately the experience of going to court in Malta, for many Maltese, is an experience of encountering a completely different reality. One of the reasons why it's a different reality is because, in fact, they encounter a more Italianate kind of culture than they are expecting. Very often they would have formed their idea of law, of what to expect of law, from films, which very often derive from the United States or from the common law world. So the experience is a kind of a culture shock. Now, I'm saying that in a way maybe we could prepare people for this culture shock, and maybe this is something which lawyers should do or should see as part of their role, by basically making it clear that our system reflects our heritage, and our heritage is a mixed one. We are we have a very European, in a sense, culture, in the sense that it is not only the common law, but it is not only the English and the common law experience which has shaped our legal culture, but also very much the Italian, French, German, even. So this is something perhaps we don't present very often as a good thing, but actually it is, because it means that the law reflects more the different dimensions of Maltese identity. So people may be experiencing as a culture shock something which they should experience as actually a reclamation of who they really are as Maltese.
How is this balance maintained within the jurisdictions?
Well, it's interesting that, as Palmer puts it, there are three different types of legal actors or jurists and lawyers who exist in mixed jurisdictions, and I think this is very important actually for Malta as well, and it's something I wish I knew more about. He claims that in mixed jurisdictions you find, particularly the third legal family, you find purists, pollutionists, and pragmatists. Purists, he argues, are those who want to maintain the connection to the continental tradition. Sometimes it's for more than legal reasons, it can be cultural. As well. It may be because of an attachment to a particular culture, a particular language, and so on. But pollutionists are those who come from outside very often, who aren't themselves native to the tradition, but instead are Anglo-American lawyers who, you know, in the case of Louisiana, teach in that tradition. And they, frankly, very often have little interest in the continental traditions, and in fact often have been taught that theirs is the best tradition in the world, and they'd be happy to see things change in those mixed jurisdictions, be happy to see them become proper, to use their thinking, Anglo-American jurisdictions. And finally, pragmatists, who are, you know, the great majority, the great bulk of practicing lawyers, who are just interested in getting on with the job and have to be aware of the complexities of their jurisdiction, but aren't really so worried about the scholastic arguments about what it is, what sort of system it actually is.
Palmer argues that in mixed jurisdictions, jurists tend to divide into purists, pollutionists, and pragmatists, depending on whether they resist the influence of foreign elements into their legal system, willingly incorporate these elements, or else simply want to go on with their job and do not care much about the origins of the particular rules they deal with. Where on this spectrum would you locate the majority of Maltese legal professionals?
My first tendency, or rather my immediate reaction, is to say that they are pragmatists. But I think reflecting a bit further about this distinction which Palmer makes, I think it's clear that in reality it's not always easy to classify people into these different categories, because the same person who might make a pragmatist argument at one moment in time might make a purist argument at another. And in fact, there are often very good pragmatic reasons for being purist. In other words, it might be very much in your interest in a particular case, for example, to argue for a purist understanding of the law rather than for a pragmatic one. So I think that rather than thinking of this distinction in terms of different categories of jurists, we should think of it in terms of different kinds of arguments which could be made. In other words, different forms of reasoning, different ways of handling the mixed legal system, the mixity in the system. Okay, I'll get it right eventually. Now, why is it good to think in terms of these classifications? I think, first of all, it's a matter of becoming aware of how you are reasoning. And I think very often we don't ask these questions about how we are thinking and why we are thinking the way we are. And I think the corollary of becoming aware is that choices which are made implicitly could be made on the basis of reasoned discussion. So rather than allowing our system to emerge from a process of a kind of biological process of osmosis, sometimes pollutionist arguments are made, sometimes pragmatic, sometimes purist, I think that we would really go about creating a system out of the mixedness in Malta if we were to start asking these questions: what is the proper space for pollutionist argument? Maybe there are areas where such arguments can legitimately be made. What is the proper space for a purist argument? So I think that rather than thinking of this as a struggle which will be decided in favor of one class of jurists rather than another, we should think of this as being a debate which necessarily arises, which is inevitable when you have a system like ours, and recognize that in a way, we should become specialists precisely in providing answers to the debate as to when to use which argument and when to use the other. And I think if that were to happen, then our mixedness would no longer be just a badge of inferiority or a badge of not having fully made it to become common lawyers or civilian lawyers, but it would become a source of strength, because we would be the people who theorize hybridity. And in the process, maybe we could resolve some of our own identity issues as well.
So, is this legal hybridity?
Well, it is. And as I define it, legal hybridity is actually quite a broad concept. What I'd like to do is combine the scholarship that's been generated on mixed systems with, and particularly, obviously by comparative lawyers, particularly with the material that's been done on the third legal family, though there are others, and first of all broaden it to include other mixtures around the world. And I'm certainly not alone in this. There's a fine scholar, Esin Arouju, who teaches at Glasgow, the University of Glasgow. She's Turkish, and not surprisingly being Turkish, she wants to include more exotic mixtures than simply mixtures of European law. But I want to go even further, and this is part of my project with Professor or Dr. Zammit, is to look not only beyond the European legal traditions, but also look to what social scientists, in particular legal anthropologists and sociologists, call legal pluralism, other types of normative systems that create norms or rules of that are important to us every day in social life as well. So hybridity includes not just legal mixtures, but things that at least lawyers would claim to be non-legal, social norms. I want to look at both of those and combine them with the idea of what I call diffusion, which is just the migration, the movement of law. So the short explanation is that legal hybridity and diffusion is about legal mixtures and movements.
Earlier in the program, you mentioned pollutionists, but don't you think that mixing legal traditions can only enhance the legal system?
Well, again, I think it's a complex question. I think that some balance has to be found in the system for the system to function, and it can be confusing or disorienting if your system is, in some sense, a minority system, particularly in a situation like, and I guess I'm thinking as Louisianian, we're one state of 50, and so we have to be concerned about what's going on in those other 49 states, and at the same time, if we want to defend our unique mixture, we have to think consciously about that. I think there are many who argue that mixed jurisdictions are, and particularly from a law and economics type focus, are a place in which the most useful, efficient ideas can be taken from the two different systems. I think in practice it's far more closely connected to culture than it is to economics.
Dr. Zamid, do you have any comments on what Dr. Donlin has just said?
Yes, I particularly like his references to Orujo and his comment that at the end of the day, we are not just talking about hybridity from the standpoint of formal legal rules, but we're also thinking about it from the perspective of culture. And in fact, listening to him speak, I made this reflection, which is not very perhaps original, but which I think is important to keep in mind, that in a way, the same kind of processes which formed the Maltese language have also formed our legal system. In both cases, you have this process of syncretism, by which elements which appear to be very, very different and very difficult to bring together are somehow magically brought together. And I think that this, in a sense, goes both ways. That is, not only should we recognize that law and culture reflect one another, but that we should also, in a sense, celebrate this where possible. So I think that where possible, we should celebrate our legal hybridity as part of our kind of traditional multiculturalism, although I'm aware that the word multiculturalism is not always embraced by most people, and that, of course, one must keep in mind that there are many meanings which multiculturalism can have. What I think is that we should basically understand that to a large extent this is inevitable, barring our incorporation within some kind of new colonial or post-colonial, power, political power, we are likely to continue to live with this legal hybridity. The process of European harmonization, I think, is going to enrich this even further. Of course, there's going to be growing uniformity at one level, but one of the lessons one learns from studying these areas is that growing uniformity at one level tends to spark off diversity at another. So I suspect that hybridity is with us for a long time to come. It is linked to our identity. It is something we need to learn to manage, and ideally it would be better if we learn to manage it consciously. I don't want to give the impression of being too triumphalistic about this. There are clear disadvantages to having hybridity in the system, but there are also possible advantages. In either case, we need to learn how to manage it.
Earlier on, you also mentioned that there are some countries, like, for example, Israel and other, Costa Rica and so on. Is there a common factor, apart from law, perhaps cultural, or that also you can link these countries with each other?
Well, I think we have to be careful. I mean, I certainly, if we're talking about mixed jurisdictions in the sense, again, of European mixes, there is almost certainly going to be different types of Europeans involved, although the jurisdiction may not obviously be in Europe, a place like the Philippines, for example. But typically what's happened in the creation of mixed jurisdictions, the way they come about, is through being a... Now, again, this isn't true for Malta, but being a colony that is initially continental and that is then transferred, Palmer refers to as an intercolonial transfer, but a transfer to an Anglo-American jurisdiction. So in the case of the Philippines, it might have been Spanish and then American. But that process happens very often. And because there's a non-Anglophone population, not just in the Philippines, but in Louisiana at the time, we were French-speaking, our first code is in French and so on, that population wanted to defend its private law. And so its private law is, in general, continental. And that's easy to understand. It's the closest to social life, to owning property. It's closest to family law, the things that are really at the heart of a legal system. And on the other hand, because of the new connection with an Anglo-American jurisdiction, the adoption of Anglo-American criminal law and public law. Criminal law because, among different reasons, in Louisiana, I know, it wasn't all that different, frankly. So we weren't bothered by the adoption of Anglo-American criminal law. And with public law was so little developed, frankly, when most of these countries become mixed, that it didn't matter anyway. And only subsequently does it become obvious that it's important. So these mixed jurisdictions are defined, and perhaps I should have said this earlier, but defined as mixtures of continental private law and Anglo-American criminal and public law, generally speaking. Again, I think it is more complicated in a place like Malta. And I think in particular, I think the question that needs to be asked, insofar as my reading directs me at the moment, is about the practice of the courts. Are your procedures adversarial in the way that Anglo-American procedures are? Or are they inquisitorial in the way that continental procedures are, traditionally at least? Or are they some unique mix? And I think it may be that question about the role of legal procedures, and the role, as we discussed earlier, of judges, that will define whether or not Malta is part of the third legal family or a close relative mixed jurisdiction.
Sfortunatament, il-ħin li kenna u l-Katalina skadjenna u wasanna fit min program miħor fi sensila bil-ħaq u s-sewa li ringrazzja il-żewġ mistiden li kenna l-lum Dr. David Zamit u Dr. Sean Donlin. Li ringrazzja u koll il-membri fit tim tal-produzzjoni Paul Borch u Selim Bohaġer. Bil-ħaq u s-sewa jaġi kum maqom bħallum ġimma fl-istess ħin jiena Alistair Buġeja fl-imkien ma' Fed Borch nishtuqulkom s-saha.